Instructions for living a life. Pay attention. Be astonished. Talk about it. That's poet Mary Oliver, and this is Everyday Wonder, a podcast where we turn down the volume on all the shouting that's going on these days so we can talk about the things that really matter. I'm Brett Will Taylor, and joining us is my Everyday Wonder co-host, Renee Peck.
Hello, Brett Will.
Hello, Renee. And our forever guest, the City of New Orleans, who if you get really quiet, you can hear her say hello. And also our resident bon vivant, who is our guest today, James Brunell Williams.
Hi.
Hi. And today we're talking about the wonder of what we leave behind after the lights go out for the proverbial last time. In other words, what we leave behind when we die. It's something that all of us, if not outright act on, maybe at least should ponder, because you know the day is going to come. And the idea for today's episode began, like most of our episodes do, with a conversation. This particular one was a check-in with James, who was very involved with the graceful and delicate final journey of a friend who was dying. Now, if you've ever been in that situation, you know it's an experience rich with sadness, but also full of wonder. There are so many threads to unravel, so much grace and tenderness, but also pain and sorrow. But James, as he does so well, rather than go through the whole thing, when he and I caught up, zeroed in on one story. And I think, James, let's dive into this episode with you sharing that story.
He and his family actually were dear friends of mine when I moved to Lafayette, Louisiana in 1992. And we just met by accident and through the years have been very close. They had a couple of homes here in New Orleans over the time, over years. So when I moved here, I would see them often. He was a pretty big deal doctor in Louisiana, but he's from Shreveport originally. But has been here mostly all of his life. That's why I love coming to your home, because they were big art collectors. So this reminds me of being with them. So toward the end of his life, well, in the beginning when he was first diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, he had a limited amount of time, and he knew it. And he's a doctor, so he accepted it. His family couldn't understand that because, you know, they wanted him to fight, but he knew the fate. So I would stay with him a lot. And when we were alone, one thing that occurred to me was, what did you want to say to his family? And so I decided to offer to him to record anything he wanted to share with his children, with his wife, every day that we would meet. And that was one of the most important things I think I could have ever offered him. And what I'm finding out now is his family, as I'm starting to share the stories that he told me, which I didn't do immediately.
That's beautiful.
What kind of stories did he tell?
So I sort of went down the road with him, assuming that since we had a limited amount of time and I didn't know how much time I had left with him being coherent, that I offered him to write the stories about his family. So his three daughters and his wife. And so those were the stories that they were more like tributes. And they were things that he said that I'm still trying to decide if I'm going to share all of them or not, because some of it, I don't know if it really matters. Some of it, I do think they need to hear. But it was about each one of the girls and then his wife. All of it was all rather touching and also very honest and real, too, as well. You know, not everything was perfect in the world, I think, for him.
The wonderful part about it is that he had the opportunity to articulate what he felt. And I think so many of us don't take the time or opportunity to do that, particularly at the end of our lives.
Well, and the wonder is also that he had you in his life, and to see that opportunity and help him take it.
And maybe our finest hours as friends was not until his death, and I'm realizing that now.
Interesting.
Yeah, I am. That is awfully, awfully powerful. What was that process of leaving behind, of how he wanted to be remembered? What was it like for you?
I think for me, I tried, even though I've known him since 1992, I was trying to step back and act like I was just not even really there. I had originally offered to bring him paper and to write, and I said, I won't share, I won't even look, I'll bring you an envelope, you can seal it in front of me. But he got to the point where he was too weak to do that, and that was when I started bringing my laptop and offered him complete privacy to write whatever he wanted. And I said, well, I think the easiest way for us to do this is, what do you want to tell your girls? He had three girls and then his wife. And so we did it that way. We
put a structure around it.
Right. And I think it was easier for him to manage at that point.
You know, and I think the beautiful thing is when James, one of the beautiful things is when James told me this story, I had just received a new book by Walt Whitman. And we talked mm-hmm. about this, and what James and his friend did is what Whitman did with someone who was a friend of his in his final years, and that was have the final say of your own life. And I think that is something all of us want to do in a way, right? And Renee, I know you and I've talked about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I also have a good friend, Sharon Litwin, who died of pancreatic cancer. And I think she too knew in the last year or two of her life that that this was it. And I think she spent a lot of that time trying to spare her friends of any kind of despair or sadness or mourning. She always looked toward the far horizon. She kept planning. She kept talking. She kept upbeat in a way that was inspirational to me. So I think you, as the repositor, being the repository of these stories that you are caretaker of now, is a wonderful homage to a friend and gave him a way to depart life eloquently and well. And I think Sharon told her own story by the way that she lived the end of her life, which was amazing to me. She never talked about her illness, and she never quit planning, and she never quit writing, and she never quit planting seeds that we are even sowing today, including this podcast, which has its roots in her legacy.
Oh, wow. That's a neat
Yeah, show. And we talk about this podcast being about lowercase wonder. And I think this episode is also, in a way, a quiet and gentle episode, right? Because Death and I go way back. As a little boy, I was very, very sick. And I knew, probably beginning at about the age of four, that there was a good chance that I would die as a child. My adrenal glands didn't function, and I had a lot of other problems. And, of course, as that little boy, I knew death meant you weren't here anymore. But I didn't understand what that meant. I just knew it was something. I just kind of thought my life. I remember watching when Mary Tyler Moore Show was going off the air, and she was like, I decided to go out on top. I remember as this little boy going, oh, that's what's going to happen to me. I'll just sort of, my life will get canceled and the rest of it will go on, and who cares? And it wasn't until after I had left New Orleans, actually, the first time, and a friend of mine, Dominique, died suddenly, and after she died, she came to me one day, and she just said, you know, Brett, Will, the lights just go off.
That is really, really disturbing.
Well, this is why we have wine. But see, to me, it's not disturbing because, A, it's what it's perhaps what happens. You know, I think we have to use the caveat for a show like this. None of us know what happens after we die, and we're not talking that much about the journey of the dying. What we're focused on here is, before you take that final step across that final threshold, what do you look behind and leave? And, you know, maybe this is a good place to say, for all of us to share, you know, Renee, what do you want to leave behind?
Well,
or do you think about it?
I think events make us think about it. If we have an illness or if someone close to us dies, we think about it. Otherwise, I'm one who lives more in the moment, and I'm one who's been very lucky not to be around death a lot, the D word. And honestly, when we talked about this episode, it was a little disturbing to me because I think people in this culture really don't want to talk about death and dying. What we're talking about here is how we're remembered. And I guess all of us want to be remembered in a positive way. We want to be remembered for the kind and good things that we did in this life. And I think part of it is taking stock. Is that what your friend was doing, maybe, James?
I think it's exactly what he was doing. One of his last things when he was still able to go out, there was a dinner with his family, and the only thing he said was, I don't want you to forget about me. He wasn't interested in this big dramatic display or a huge funeral, although he had one because he designed it. But his only thing was, I don't want my family to forget about me. And that was it.
You know, this reminds me of a movie I watched with my 2-year-old granddaughter, Blake, and her mother said her favorite movie is Coco. And I said, okay, I'll watch it, thinking this animated Disney film was Pixar.
Coco Puffs, like breakfast
whatever.
Cereal, sugary.
Yes, and in it, and you've seen it, James, mm-hmm, correct?
I have.
This little boy is looking for his ancestors and crosses into the land of death and spends the entire movie wandering around the land of the dead with his ancestors, and the idea being that if he can't find a picture for them to remember the ancestors by, the ancestors disappear. So the idea is, if you forget me, you're gone. But if you don't forget me, if you remember me in any way at all, I continue to exist even in the land of the dead. So it was a very strange movie for me, but I really sort of got engrossed in it, and I can see why it's so compelling, because that's, I guess, the human need is to be remembered.
And why?
Because it makes us significant. It makes us meaningful. It means that we mattered to someone.
So, you know, because I have a little bit of a different take, which I will share,
well,
perhaps.
Of course
exactly.
You do.
But, you know, what's interesting is when you say we want to be remembered, we want to know we mattered, et cetera, we're talking about identity here. You know, we're talking about that blessing and curse of being human, which is the letter, the capital I. I was here. And I find it fascinating that that's not enough. That
what do you mean it's not enough?
That it's not enough to be here when you were here. You want people to remember you're here after you're gone. And now, let me be really clear about that. We want to leave something behind for purely selfish ego reasons that are the all caps, I was here, and, you know, as Judy Garland said at the end of her life, attention must be paid. Or is it a gentle remember, so in the case of your friend, James, remember how I loved you and what I believed in you? Or I know for Sharon, Renee, you know, when you remember Sharon now, you remember her as, and this isn't necessarily the right word, but as a motivator. The death of Sharon inspires how you live today.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when the last time I saw Sharon, John Pope, who writes obits in New Orleans and is well known for writing obits, was going to write Sharon's obit. And so when I went to see Sharon, I asked John, I said, what do you want me to ask her? And he said, ask her, I always ask people who I interview often before they die, I ask them, what is their rosebud moment? And it goes back to Citizen Kane and the meaning of Rosebud and that in his life. And what is that moment for each of us that is the epitome of meaning in our life? So it's not about identity or ego or what they did or how many millions they give to charity or whatever, but what was that one essential piece of them that created their identity more than any? And I don't know, James, was your friend, I mean, I think he was passing his love along to his family, and that was a great, probably brought him great solace.
I think it made him so happy. I remember one of the things he told me once is, I need as much love as I can possibly get right now. And that was why he wanted to have everyone, you know, come and visit. But I think also by telling the stories and sharing with me, knowing it was going to go back to his daughters and his wife one day, gave him peace.
Do you think that because he had you as a conduit or a person to record those stories, did he go deeper?
He did. One of the last things he told me, when this was the last day that I remember him actually being coherent, one of the things out of his mouth was, we certainly do have a lot of secrets. And we did. But I think it was just because when you're at this point in your life, you are sharing more about your family and your kids, and you don't, you know, you need this one person to be able to tell the oral history, so to speak, of their life.
I love that, because what you've just said, James, it's clear that death was in the room with you all, because, you know, what's the old cliche about death, which is in our final moments, we realize what really mattered. And we say, aha, and then that's it. And I think, you know, the beauty of perhaps thinking of what you want to leave behind or being intentional about it is you're doing it before death takes its seat next to you. And perhaps if you think about what you want to leave behind before death sits down next to you, you have a little more say in what you want to leave behind.
Well, I think so. I don't know that people are that thoughtful about it. I do know that in New Orleans, as James has mentioned, people think about their death and in a very non-traditional way, a celebratory way. In New Orleans, death is often something to be celebrated as opposed to feared. And New Orleanians don't seem to fear it or as much as maybe other cultures. For example, Ruth Fertel, who started Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, gave herself a huge party at Metairie Lake Lawn Cemetery in 1999. She erected a big monument. She spent $500,000 on it. She invited all of her friends. She had a great a great send-off.
Food. Remember?
Right. And then she died 3 years later. Al Copeland did much the same thing. He built a big monument to himself, room for 14 caskets with columns and a bronze double door. And I didn't know this until I was Googling this recently, but evidently St. Louis Cemetery No. 1 has a tomb that's covered in lipstick kisses, and it is going to be where Nicolas Cage puts himself at the end of his life. He's not dead yet. But I think the idea...
Not that we know of.
Right. I think the idea of... your friend planned for his death. And I think here we do find a celebratory aspect of it to the point that we want to participate in it. Is that weird?
No. And I think that there is a celebration of death to a degree here, more over than anywhere else. And in his case, and as you know, I do events and parties, and I like to go to these things. And so I would have to say, well, I think this is going to be your funeral director, Jacob Chancel. Let's, put that out of the way, contact him, and we would do different things. And then he himself went and planned everything. All of it was done in advance. And then there's this huge after party at Emerald, so he goes over and plans the menu. He did all of this stuff. And at first I was like, he's enjoying this, but it's his last party.
It's how he would be remembered. It's the big send-off.
And he did it himself. And I think he loved
it. And I think Ruth Fertel and Al Copeland wanted to be there. And so they were.
When I think of sort of controlling or over the top what we leave behind, I think of Isabel Stewart Gardner, who bequeathed her home to the city of Boston when she died to be a museum. That's awesome. That's a great thing to leave behind. What some people don't realize is that she bequeathed it with exact and specific instructions that nothing was ever to be moved. Ever. And of course, that home was the site of the greatest art heist in American history. And where the Rembrandts were on the wall, it will always be blank. But she even went down, God love her, to the gardening. And so the nasturtiums may only hang from the balconies of her home at certain months of the year, and they may only be certain colors forever. Now, that's pretty controlling over what you want to leave behind.
I think one of the beauties of James's story with his friend is that it's as much about what he gave to his friend as what his friend gave to him, and that is the repository of his stories. The friend didn't come up with this idea. He didn't try to cement his stories in all perpetuity the way Isabel Stewart Gardner did. And to me, that's the big difference. And I think that those people who are listening, who know people who have been ill, who have had deaths in the family, who cannot cope with that or have difficulty coping with that, can learn from James, because there are ways that we can give as that journey happens and make things better for those people and perhaps enable them to be remembered in a more positive way. I don't think people like her care that much about the journey. They only care about their stamp on things.
Well, and they care about how they will be remembered, which I think, as we talked before, is important. But, Renee, listening to you makes me remember that death is a transition. And implicit in that transition is a baton passing. You who were here before you're gone forever perhaps have the gift of passing to whoever will still be here, whatever you want to pass, which is what Sharon did with you.
And I think, James, that your gift was to as much to the family.
Well, you were the vessel of that baton.
Well, and it was something that I did have to explain to them in this moment of when it did become, you know, the moment of grief he passes and the disparity of it all. What's happening now? I have lost my will. You know how you automatically have these sort of things. But I stressed very much that it was their responsibility to carry on his legacy and to make sure that they told his story to the children and grandchildren that are too young maybe to know him completely or won't know the whole story. And that was where their responsibility was with them now. And I think that gave them hope.
You know, it's funny. Stuart and I joke a lot about epitaphs because an epitaph is basically sort of a haiku.
Well, and you're an editor, so you
well,
love
it's them. Like it's like this shortcut to summing up what you're leaving, how you're being remembered, who you are. And some people do it with great humor, and some people do it with thoughtfulness, and some people write their own, and some people have others write it. Stuart always said that his epitaph is going to be, "I'm starting my diet tomorrow," which is probably how all of us will remember him when he goes. Senator John McCain, who died not so long ago, told an interviewer that he had chosen his own epitaph and that his gravestone would read that he served his country. So I think that that's kind of a way of summing up how we want to be remembered. And it's like human personality and attitude across the spectrum, and that is some are funny, some are sad, some are heartwarming, some are, you know, I think we all differ into what we want to leave.
Well, and I think, you know, what I love about this particular conversation, all we're merely suggesting is that folks perhaps think about what you want to leave behind. And not at the very end of your life, but maybe during your life, right? As Stephen Sondheim reminded us, every day a little death. And I think the beauty, I hope the beauty or the wonder of this conversation for some of the folks who are listening is, you know, while thinking about death is very difficult for some folks, I think we miss the wonder of what is behind that difficulty when we turn away from it in a knee-jerked way. And, you know, James, what's beautiful to me is you actively looked for the wonder and the way to be that baton with your friend in ways that he perhaps didn't have the energy to at least start to think about. So you opened a door for him. As we get ready to sign off, you know, for listeners, we've touched on what you leave behind in two different ways, right? There's the very public piece, which I happen to think is the superficial and the part that probably won't last. And then there's the very private piece.
You know, you talk about intentional a lot. I would add that there's also the unintentional.
Correct.
And I think that if you think about it, and if you think about people who are important in your life who have gone on, you realize that you do sort of shorthand sum up what they left behind. My maternal grandmother was the maternal one. She was the great maternal one who loved the babies and always, you know, gave you the hug. My other paternal grandmother was the feisty, crazy one who, you know, spotted airplanes in World War II. And so we do, throughout our lives, leave behind our identities through the accumulation of every moment that we live. But perhaps when you do it thoughtfully, like your friend does, and do it in a summation, then maybe we better see who ourselves are.
Well, and I think it comes down to you know, choice, and especially when you think of what you leave behind when you're not here, there sure as hell isn't one right way to do it or one right response. You know, what I'd like to do is leave us with my favorite way to think of what we leave behind, and it comes from Rumi, and I think in many ways it sums up everything that the three of us have said. It's from a poem of Rumi's, and it goes like this. At the end of my life, with just one breath left, if you come then, I'll sit up and sing. And may whatever we choose to leave behind, whenever we do, be about singing and be about wonder. James, thank you for joining us and sharing your beautiful story. City of New Orleans, thanks for hovering and flying around us with your wonder. Renee, thanks as always for being here. Sharon, wherever you are, thank you. This is Brett Will Taylor, and thanks to all of you listeners for joining us for this episode. We'll see you next week. The wild is a beautiful place. Such a beautiful place. Such a beautiful place.